What I'm pointing out here is that everybody's saying, okay, I have an AC signal, and the electrons are swinging back and forth from molecule to molecule. I'm saying that they're not. What's actually happening is that you have valence electrons exchanging energy in each pass. If you look at a molecule with that, or just a basic atom, where you have different orbitals, and you have an outside orbital, which is the valence orbital. That valence orbital is the electron that's able to exchange energy from one electron to the other. So what's actually happening is that electron, as it's passing in its orbit, so all of the other three-dimensional atoms surrounding it, it's exchanging information. It's just passing it back and forth, back and forth. Now, when you're looking at a coulomb of current, a coulomb of charge and a current flow through that direction, that's really representing the amount of valence electrons required to create that current flow. KC2, QIQ.
And you and I may have read slightly different books, and we may have a slightly different impression on this one. We've got to go over the pole real fast, pretty soon, but the way it was described to me is that the outer valence electron, in the case of copper, one single electron in the outer valence shell is completely free to do whatever he wants. Before you hook it up to any circuit, that copper wire has those free electrons running around like a cloud. They're not tied down to any one copper molecule. They're hopping all over the place. They have a significant amount of motion. I'm not sure of their exact velocity.
Can I ask you this question then, Dick?
And that velocity is a very high number. And just because they're at 300 degrees Kelvin, there's a hell of a lot of motion of those before you hook them up to a circuit. I can prove that by you and I connecting it to a very sensitive receiver, and I can measure the noise power that's created by that motion. Go ahead and ask your question, Glenn.
Well, you brought temperature into the picture, which is another thing altogether, but we're just going to confuse the matter, so I'll yield on this one for now. I'll have to pick it up later, because I know Paul's going to do a space report. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, most of the circuits you and I work with, Glenn, are operating at very close to room temperature, 290 Kelvin. We consider that a nice warm temperature. As far as Mother Nature is concerned, that's a huge temperature. Lots and lots of motion is taking place before you hook it up to a circuit. So with all of that random motion going on, with no average current flowing in any one direction, a whole lot of random current, I can measure it with a very sensitive receiver. I've done that. Minus 114 dBm per megacycle at room temperature, any old resistor that I impedance match, because of the random motion due to temperature. Now I hook it up to a circuit, and I create some slightly different mean value to all of that, but that random motion doesn't stop just because I hooked it up to a circuit. Paul, WS2N, are you there? And some interesting things are going on in space. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay. WS2N. Can you drop it? Yeah, listening to all that is today. Page 417, Electron for Sale, on the book Thinking Physics. I just looked it up while we're listening, and they had that whole deal about the AC, and the only thing that they're selling you is the energy, not the electrons from the electric company. But space topic, Dick. Just a couple of things. I talked about the New Star telescope that's supposed to be launched on the 22nd of this month, now delayed for two more months. It had a delay for about a week, and now it's going to be two more months before that launches from Kwajalein Island out by Midway from the Pacific. They had some software problems. The rocket's not talking to the Pegasus properly. They want to square that all out before they launch that thing. So we've talked about that quite a bit. That's the one that's going to be looking for hard X-rays. So, drop it. So we'll talk about that, I guess, two more months from now. It's going to be that's the one with, it's about 30 some odd feet apart between the detectors and the optics, and it should be about 10 to 100 times more powerful than Chandra Space Telescope, because it has the ability to focus where that one doesn't. The other thing I wanted to mention is the Air Force launched a geosynchronous satellite a year or so ago, and they called it the AEHF. It stood for Advanced Extremely High Frequency Satellite. Basically a fancy communication satellite for the military. This is almost a $2 billion satellite. There's going to be like five more of these things that are eventually going to go up. This one went up on an Atlas, that's a heavy lift rocket from Cape Canaveral over a year ago. And they had problems with it. It's supposed to go into geosynchronous orbit. It first went into a planned elliptical orbit. They wanted to light off the engine to put it into a proper orbit. They tried that. It shut itself down. They tried it again. It shut itself down as a safety precaution because they realized one of the lines were clogged. Let me drop it. And they figured out that somebody left a rag in one of the fuel lines. So rather than give up on this thing, they tried for over a year, and they did a couple of good maneuvers to try to save this expensive satellite. And one thing they used was the maneuvering rockets to try to get into not only a higher orbit, but one that favored the sun. It has big solar panels on it, favored the sun a little bit better. And it's at it's almost an equatorial orbit, like 22 degrees inclination, so it's not one of these polar satellites, heading for a geosynchronous orbit. So now they got the thing oriented properly, and it has on board, this is one of the things I like, it has a Hall engine on it, similar to an ion engine, a Hall effect engine. So now that the solar panels are taking in the electricity, they have enough power to run this this Hall effect engine, which has very little thrust, but could run like forever, similar to an ion engine. And it has now, worked its way into a geosynchronous orbit. So they saved this satellite and dropped it. It was an interesting save. When you think about, $1.7 billion, I mean, it's not a NASA satellite. It's it comes under the military budget. If you think about the budget for NASA, I think it's less than half of 1% of the total next budget. So, I mean, NASA has such a little one. But the military is big. So, let's work out. It's a whole rocket on board. Instead of the regular ion engine. Apparently, there's a difference between the two. I've been looking it up, and it looks like the Hall effect runs on a system where they have electrons flowing between these big magnets, and then they have the xeon gas. This as well, heavy element. I mean, theoretically, you could do it with any kind of gas, but because the heavy element, when it gets propelled out of the back, it has a tendency to have more thrust than a lighter gas, so that's why they use this xeon gas. And apparently this magnetic field with electrons going back and forth helps break up the xeon gas, ionizes it, and make an electrostatic system. They shoot the gas out the back, so they get the constant thrust. Designed by the Russians. Drop it. and in the mouth. It's consumed with me. I've put one of those instruments in the time to watch from my wife on in Virginia. They have a launch facility there in Kitchen, Virginia. And they were going to launch this. They were going to run about 60 miles and release her.
Transmission from
wave into APG. Was that true, Dave? Go ahead.
Yes, that's a quick astronomy note.
Okay, a quick sounding, I think you said. Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, just a quick note. I'm on the topic of astronomy note. Over.
Okay, I'm hearing you beautifully on the input. Dave says he's got a quick astronomy note. Go ahead with your astronomy note, Dave. I'll be repeating it because right now you're not coming through.
Roger, NCACQ. Yeah, just let everybody know that any one of these nights for the next, couple of weeks, they can go outside and see five planets in one night. You've got Venus and Jupiter in the west, and you've got Mars is up. Saturn comes,
yeah,
and you can look down and see the Earth underneath you, so you can see in one night.
Okay, to repeat what Dave just told us, right now, for the next couple of months, you can go out at night and see five planets, and those are Mercury, Venus, Jupiter. Those are the two that were recently in a close conjunction. Mars comes up a little bit later. Saturn comes up a little bit later. So right now, a little bit late at night, you can see Venus, Jupiter, Mars, Saturn, and the fifth planet is Earth, the one below you. We don't often use a telescope on that one. Well, that, sometimes I do when I look at my neighbor's window with my telescope, but that's another whole subject. Okay. Glenn wants to go back to the previous subject. I may have to listen to you on the input and repeat what you're saying, Glenn, but go right ahead. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, actually, before we do, Dick, I was just going to ask, could you just point out the direction of Saturn? I know that we've been viewing Venus off to the west, and I know Mars has been relatively east to straight up, depending upon the evening. What direction of the sky do we look at to view Saturn, and how bright will it be?
Okay,
yeah,
right in the front. Venus and Jupiter on the... to the west at sunset. Venus and Jupiter are to the west at sunset. Mars and Saturn both are much higher up and are rising from the east. So exactly where Saturn is, I'm not sure, but it's either a lot higher up or a lot further to the east. We'll have to do a little bit more research on that one. And Saturn is quite a bit dimmer than Jupiter. Venus was that super bright one that you saw over the last week or so to the west. That was very close to Jupiter. Venus was a much brighter one. Jupiter's a little bit dimmer. Saturn is quite a bit dimmer than Jupiter. With a good telescope, that's not much of a problem, but to the naked eye, Saturn is quite...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater,
timeout. Cancel. Mars is recognizable by its characteristic red color. At around midnight or so, Mars is fairly high in the sky. And where Saturn is right now, I'm not sure. I wonder if we've got an astronomer on frequency who can tell us where Saturn is right at this time. K2RIW, I'll be listening.
Yeah, N2APG. Dick, Saturn right now is low in the east. Low in the east. Copy.
Roger, Roger, we got that. Low in the east is where Saturn is. So there are various websites that will help us find those things, Glenn. Glenn, you want to go back to the previous subject, and before you do that, you're going to give me a sentence as to how big is your particular telescope? What kind of a telescope have you got there in Massapequa? Because N2APG is also in the same town with you, and he's down to his last 30 sets of binoculars and quite a few telescopes. KC2QIQ, K2L.
Telescope. I don't even use a pair of binoculars. I've been just enjoying going out in the evening and looking out to the western sky, and seeing Jupiter and Venus, very nice to see. It's typically been east to straight up, depending on the time of the evening, but it's got that nice red glow, like you said. Wonderful to watch, but as I don't recall seeing Saturn yet, and I'll have to look into that one a little bit more. But I think YDT is out there. It might just break for a second to see if he has a comment or something first at KC2QIQ.
Okay, I'm hearing you on the input, so go ahead, Matt.
Hey, C2IC. Hey, I just wanted to let you guys know, I know many of us have smartphones now. They actually have a great free application out for astronomy called Google Sky Map. If you download that app and you put it on your phone and hold your phone up to whatever you're viewing, it will show you everything that's supposed to be there. Constellations, stars, planets, you name it, they have it.
Very fine, Matt. That's good to know. So Google Sky Map. That's something to go look for. Sounds like a goodie. Now, you wanted to say something further on the subject of charge transfer of 1 ampere, which is 1 coulomb per second moving past a particular point of interest. But to my knowledge, the way the Bureau defines 1 ampere, that's one of the ways they define 1 ampere. It's also a given number of electrons, I think, is another way, which happens to be equal to 1 coulomb. And I know you want to discuss this a little bit further, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW. I'll hear you on the input, so don't worry.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Actually, what I was just going to mention was, you know, the way that the atom is described in a fixed temperature, fixed pressure environment is that, you know, you have your, in the conductor, you've got the valent energy shell, and the way that the energy seems to be transferring is the from electron to electron. So the electron is really described as the energy carrier, so that as each valence orbit comes in contact but not touching an opposing atom with a valence energy level, basically the electron is acting like passing a torch. It's passing the energy to the valence electron shell next to it. So basically the two electrons pass by each other, and of course the more available valence electrons, the more available capabilities for one electron to pass the energy onto the electron or valence shell next to it. Let me let this drop for a second. So the question comes, when is the electron jumping from one electron to the other? Well, each electron, atom has an EV count or a maximum. If that gets exceeded, then the electron will bounce and try to find another hole in an open valence shell next to it, which it can share that valence electron shell. Now, it will actually move. But sometimes the item came up about superconductor. And what is the superconductor? Well, one definition that I gave was a mu equals zero. Well, what mu equals zero really means is that the atom is never reaching the EV saturation level, which means that the valence electron shells, basically the electrons are out there, they can exchange energy, but they don't move. So in other words, they don't jump from one atom to the next. So when achieved, what's actually happening is the valence electrons are able to transfer energy freely from one atom to the next without having the valence electron move from atom to atom. KC2QIQ.
May I have a comment on it?
N2HVR is recognized. West is recognized. The way it's been explained to me, Glenn, and maybe you agree, maybe you disagree, is that there's one single free electron in the outer valence shell of each copper atom. So if you and I have got a whole bunch of copper atoms in our copper wire, and we assume for simplicity now there's no contaminant, those electrons, I'm reasonably sure, are not staying tied.
Repeater, time out.
I'm reasonably sure that those electrons are not staying tied to any one particular copper atom. They're floating all over the place before we apply any current. And I agree with you on one other thing, and that is those electrons each have an extremely strong local negative charge. Therefore, when any two electrons come close to each other, they absolutely positively don't touch. They repel each other like crazy. So they're dancing all over the place even before we hook them up to a circuit. And you can easily prove that by connecting a sensitive receiver and measuring the noise that's created by their random motion. The same thing with air molecules. The air molecules in that room with you are moving 500 meters per second, and they're not touching each other. They come close, but the extremely strong electrostatic charge of each air molecule on the outer shell of its electrons is such that they just bounce off of the vicinity of each other, never touch. So the electrons don't touch. I accept that. And as such, any excess velocity of any one electron can easily be transferred to the next electron he encounters, because that extra energy, by the ping-pong paddle effect, even though there's no real contact, by the ping-pong paddle effect, that energy can be transferred. I think you know what I mean by the ping-pong paddle effect. KCQQIQ, KQRIW.
Drag your feet, guys.
Yeah, absolutely, Dick. And that ping-pong paddle effect is just as you describe it, that dissimilar charge between two electrons that come close to each other basically are exchanging energy as they pass by because of their dissimilar charge. So there is actually energy transferring, even though they come close and don't even touch each other. And when they exceed that velocity, and that velocity can actually be associated back to electron volt and the energy of the total...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You didn't do it, Glenn. Don't worry. I agree with all that. And now we can talk about energy of the motion of a particular electron and the way his velocity gets transferred by the ping-pong paddle effect as he comes close to meeting another electron in this cloud of electrons that are moving all over the place, even before you and I apply an external voltage with our circuit, which moves some... Nicholas wanted to say something. N2HVR, who just signed in by, I think it was IRLP or... Echo Link. Go right ahead, Nicholas. KQRIW.
I just wanted to check in. I really don't have any questions. I accidentally checked in. I was just checking my Echolink connection, and I've been listening to the net since 8 o'clock. Thank you for letting me jump in here. Just say hello to everybody, and I'll be listening. Thank you.
Very fine, Nicholas. Another person who did sign in was Alan, KC2ZUM. Alan, are you still there? KQRIW.
Actually, Cuckoo. Can I make a comment on the subject? Duke, am I getting through? This is Casey.
Go ahead, Alan, KC2ZUM. Go right ahead, KQRIW.
In about a week's time, and there's a possibility that we may not set up. Did anybody indoors? I mean, I've experimented with different antennas, though, but like a dual bander, it's something that I could use in.
Yeah. am I going to go over the tonight?
Just barely whistling. He's hitting me hard at 30 over here.
Nicholas, you talked about an indoor antenna, a dual bander, and something about a week ago. I missed some of those details, Nicholas, but I think you're saying you did use a dual bander indoors and you were relatively successful, relatively happy with it. Is that sort of what you're saying, Alan? KC2ZUM, K2RIW.
Leakage a little bit. It just seemed like it was getting into areas that a regular GP1 didn't.
Yeah, I have a question, a comment on this.
Yeah, yes, Dick, I did. As a matter of fact, if you want to pick it up from here, go right ahead. KC2QIQ.
On a quick break, though, if I measured the average amount of energy of each individual electron that's floating around freely, hopping around in between the copper molecules, before I apply any current, and then when I apply a current, I start biasing things in one particular direction. I apply a potential difference across the wire, and I start creating a current flow. But before I do that, do you have a gut feel as to what is the amount of energy on the average electron on his motion when he's hopping between copper molecules? Is that large or small compared to the amount of energy I add to him in a particular biased direction when I hook up my my flashlight battery and my 1.5 ohm resistor? Do you have a gut feel for what is the ratio between his random energy versus the energy that I'm creating? The energy that I'm creating a velocity, an average velocity, a bias, which has a certain amount of energy. KC2QIQ, K2RIW. I'll hear you on the input, don't worry.
That's what I have a comment on it.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Basically, my understanding of the energy of each electron is based on the atom that it's associated to. So in other words, there's a fixed level of charge and the amount of orbital shells. So if I were to count each ring of the way we calculate the energy level of each electron, it depends on which orbit it's in. So as we get, of course, out to the highest level of energies, which are the valence shell itself is what really is determining the amount of energy. Now, if the electron count in the valence shell exceeds the maximum amount of energy that is allowed for that particular atom, what will happen is then, of course, then the energy of that electron gets expelled and the electron moves to the next opposing electron atom next to it that can accept that additional energy. KC2QIQ to balance the atom next to it. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, but here's my real question. In theory, I can excite electrons to a higher orbital. That's one way I can do it. But the outer valence electron of copper is so extremely free that just by normal thermal energy of 300 degrees Kelvin, 290 Kelvin, the room temperature, I don't have to hit it. Just pure thermal energy is allowing him to hop from copper molecule to copper molecule. There's a cloud of free electrons, and that one single electron per copper molecule is completely free, essentially not bound at all, is my understanding. You're making it sound like I have to do something to free up that electron. The reading I've done leads me to believe that he is free before I do anything. You agree or disagree on that one from what you've been reading, Glenn? Go ahead.
Oh, I do, Dick. Absolutely. I consider raising the temperature doing something. What's happening is that if you look at on a very good periodic chart, you can have atomic weight. You can also have electron energy shells per valence. The valence, and of course, each energy shell of the available number of electrons, the number of electrons in each shell, and then you can count that all up. And then not only does it have an atomic number, it has an EV number. So basically, there's a charge number or EV number associated to a specific atom at a specific temperature. Now, if you were to increase the temperature, then what would happen is you can reach a saturation point for which that temperature will exceed the maximum amount of energy for that atom. So now that electron is now free to move to, in other words, to maintain an equilibrium to the electron next to it. And this pattern takes place within all of the molecules in their free temperature range all the way around that copper until it reaches the outermost part of the copper, which could be air, which could be some other thing, and then that energy will move from there into air or somewhere else as a form of radiation of heat pattern. KC2QIQ.
Can I make a comment?
Yeah, hold on a minute, Wes. There's something that's not quite going down correctly from what I've been hearing, Glenn. in order to take any one particular electron in any particular orbital or suborbital and raise them to the next higher location, any particular electron that's in orbit around a particular copper nucleus, takes an extremely specific amount of energy, a very specific wavelength of energy is required to do that. If I'm simply applying heat to a copper bar, I am putting in tremendous amounts of random energy, not on any one specific wavelength. Each copper molecule is locked in a matrix, and those matrices are sort of like a bunch of springs in between in all of the copper molecules. When I heat up that bar of copper, I am shaking each complete molecule in that matrix. I'm shaking them against the springs by which each molecule is locked in its position. They're not really locked. They're held together with a bunch of springs. So my random thermal energy rocks all of them back and forth in position. That is not the right wavelength to raise the electrons to the next higher orbit. That outer valence electron, he doesn't require any energy. He is free to move even before I do anything. But to raise or lower an electron in an orbit requires a very specific wavelength going in, and he gives off a very specific wavelength coming back out. If you don't give him exactly that wavelength, that electron doesn't move to the next higher orbit, is my understanding, Glenn. KCQQIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, you're completely correct on that, Dick. I wasn't talking about the different orbits as moving. In other words, the only one that I was talking about exchanging was just the valence. So in other words, at a fixed temperature where the electrons are moving from one to the other, what's happening is at that depending on the temperature at which the atom is elevated, in other words, if you go down to a low enough temperature, what will eventually happen is the atomic energy count of the atom will slow down and actually stop those valence electrons from moving from one to the other. As you increase the temperature, the valence electrons will be able to be sharing more and more. That's basically the point that I was making. But they're not changing orbits. They're just exchanging valence electrons from one valence shell to the other. So they're already at that specific energy level already within the molecule itself.
It's my belief, Glenn, that those outer electrons are extremely free to move at almost any reasonable temperature. As I go down in temperature, the apparent resistivity of the copper decreases, as if the freedom of that outer valence electron even increases, if you know what I mean. If I go down in temperature, that outer electron is still extremely free to move, obvious by the fact that the resistance of that bar goes down when I go to a lower temperature. Over to you, Glenn.
Well, the way I would explain that one, Vic, is that think of it this way. If the temperature is going down, there's not more free to move from electron to electron. It's becoming less free. And what you're going to see is that the mixture between density and number of available electrons moving around that is going to be a reaching point less than. And if you lower the temperature low enough, eventually what will happen is the lesser amounts of those free electrons will have to move from one atom to the next atom. But just the sheer passes of the electrons in near misses to other atoms adjacent to it will transfer the energy without actually having to expel a valence electron to an unequally balanced valence shell next to it. KC2QIQ.
Glenn, you're making it sound as if the mobility of that outer valence electron in copper decreases with lower temperature. You're making it sound like his mobility decreases. If that's so, if his mobility is decreasing, how come the apparent resistance of copper continuously goes down? The conductivity goes up as I go lower in temperature. How do you explain that one, Glenn? Go ahead.
Okay, how I explain that is that the exchanging of one electron from atom to atom, think of that as your loss. That's your heat. But when the electrons, basically in the valence shell, in other words, remember, it's the electrons in the valence shell that are able to exchange. Think of each electron as a carrier. as if it's like two runners carrying a torch. The two runners never touch each other, but as one runner comes next to the close to the next runner, it passes the torch over. So if you have two valence shells and two opposing atoms to each other, as one valent electron comes near the valent electron next door, it hands the energy over. They share charge. They get close enough to each other to exchange the charge. So the electrons aren't jumping back and forth to move the energy. They're just exchanging charge by coming close to each other. But they don't have to move from one valent shell of one atom to the next to do that. KC2, QIQ.
Yes, they don't. They don't have to move from copper molecule to molecule. But I say they are. I think they're moving around like a cloud. They're completely free and only extremely loosely coupled for picoseconds at a time. A particular electron is apparently coupled to a particular molecule, a particular nucleus. But that's very quick. I think the majority of the time, each of these electrons in copper, the outer valence, free single electron per copper, are completely free to hop from molecule to molecule before you and I do anything. They're continuously hopping. They're not tied down in any way. And now, if that scenario happens to be true, I'm having a little bit of trouble explaining how does the resistance go down when I lower the temperature? When I lower the temperature, I'm lowering the amount of kinetic energy of the shaking of the hold on copper molecule. If I lower the amount of copper molecule shaking in place in that matrix, why does that make the freely flowing electrons in that cloud around all of those copper molecules, why does that make them appear to have lower resistance? Over to you, Glenn, K2LAW.
Okay. As I said, the electron is the energy carrier. The energy is moving as basically... okay, let's talk about charge for a minute. Let's back up to charge. What is charge? If I have two items of dissimilar charge and I bring them near each other, they will have a repulsion or repel, and it will affect the orbit of basically the electron in the opposing valence shell. So when one electron comes near the other one, it will repel it a little bit, slightly modify its orbit, just the tiniest little bit. In doing so, that orbit now has been modified, and it can move that extra amount of energy around that orbit until it comes near the next atom nearby, which is a different one, and can actually share that extra energy by taking a swipe past the electron in the next atom next to it. So this swiping action, basically, of atoms, of electrons within atoms that aren't jumping from atom to atom, they're just basically coming to so-called near misses as they go by each other, are basically exchanging differences in charge as they go by. So that's really the movement of the energy, is the exchange of charge in closely moving electrons. But when the electrons are actually moving from one valence shell of one atom to the valence shell of another atom, I call that loss for heat. KC2, QIQ.
Go ahead, John.
All right, Dick, isn't it possible that by reducing the temperature, the lattice structure reduces its area, therefore bringing the atomic structure closer together, allowing a more efficient and easier transfer of the energy from atom to atom? Is that possibly the reason for the lower resistance?
Repeater, time out.
Busy.
You're absolutely right, John, that as you lower the temperature, the thermal expansion of the copper goes down. You do get a positive temperature coefficient of expansion, and the molecules do get closer together. But the rate of thermal expansion change and the rate of resistance change, I'm a little worried they might be a very, very different rate. They're in the right direction, but I don't think the rates track. So Your hypothesis is that they get closer together when it's colder because the bar is shrinking, and that shrinking in parts per million is fairly small, And is the parts per million of change of resistivity versus temperature, is it the same? That's something we got to think about. Because they're closer together, does that make them more mobile? To me, a lower resistance material has electrons in it that are more mobile. That's what it, because the current has to flow in one average direction in order for me to get a current flow that I see on my meter. So how does the current flow in one direction? Has the mobility increase? You're saying they increase because they're closer together. That's an interesting point of view. Got to think about that one. What do you think on that one, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Can I make a comment, Dick?
Yeah, just one second, Wesley. I think what's happening here is the way I'm describing everything is that in each electron, an electron pass near a valence, there was two valence electron passes in opposing atoms are exchanging energy. There's a charge that's affecting the orbit of the one next to it without the electron having to leave the electron. I think what you're saying most of the time is that the energy...
Repeater, time out.
Okay, too wild.
Go ahead, Bernie.
On a really hot day?
You guys are going to have to leave more links, or leave more time. You're blowing the links off.
Maple beer.
Sorry, Dick. I think that was my fault. KC2QIQ.
When two air molecules almost hit each other, they transfer momentum, but there is no energy loss. In other words, I can have those air molecules bouncing against each other in a thoroughly, thermally isolated chamber, and they're hitting each other zillions of times per second. And a year later, I come back, and that thermally insulated chamber of air is at the exact same temperature. They lost no overall energy. So those bounces are transferring momentum, but no energy is lost. By the same token, the electrons that are hopping from one copper molecule to the next, and when they come close to each other and bounce off, they're conveying momentum to each other, but an electron hopping from one nucleus region to another nucleus region of a copper molecule, I think there is no mechanism of energy loss. There is no voltage across the resistance, if you know what I mean. There's no I squared R energy loss just because the electron hopped from one, from copper molecule number 5 to copper molecule number 6. I don't think that's an energy loss. Momentum can be conveyed by various interactions like that, but I don't think that's an energy loss mechanism, Glenn. Over to you, Glenn, K2LAW.
Dick, is that because it's random?
Can I reply?
I don't think it's because it's random. I think it's because when charged items come close to each other, they can convey momentum. They do not have energy loss. It's the equivalent of my having an absolutely perfect ping pong ball hitting my very massive paddle. I can convey kinetic energy by the ping pong paddle bounce, but if the ping pong ball is perfect enough, even if I bounce it once or a million times, no energy is lost. There is no heating taking place of the ping pong ball or its paddle. By the same token, I think the electron, when it hops from one copper molecule to the next, he can convey momentum, but I don't think there's an energy loss mechanism there. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, actually there is, Dick, and I'll explain what that mechanism is. If you
not
look
found.
At the model for an atom, and the energy model for an atom, each electron is a carrier of energy, and look at each orbital, and each orbital has an energy level until you get to the valence shell. And the valence shell has an energy level. So that energy level is maintained by its orbit. So as long as it's in that valence energy shell is in orbit, it has that energy level. Once the overall, so in other words, when you do that total electron count and count up all of the energy of each one of the electrons in that atom, that's fixed maximum amount of energy for that atom. If the amount of energy coming in and going out of the atom exceeds the EV count, that electron has no, because it doesn't have another atom next to it to transfer the energy, it has to go out and find it. So basically what it does is it leaves the orbit of the first atom, goes to the next one, in hope to find the next atom next to it that has an open carrier, so it can jump in and reestablish its orbit on the new atom. Does that make more sense? So the energy loss is actually too much energy going in to the point that it actually pushes it out and it jumps over. So there's a momentum loss from one orbit, from one atom, over to the orbit of the adjacent atom that it eventually finds its home in. KC2QIQ.
When an outer valence electron of copper, and they're the only ones that are moving, all the others, for reasonable stories that you and I are talking about right now, all the other orbitals of all the electrons on that copper nucleus, they're not changing. Nobody has given them exactly the right wavelength. But that outer one is very free to move. And in his huge freedom to move, he decides right now to leave the area of copper molecule number 5. When he does, copper molecule number 5 is now more positive. Because an electric charge negative just left him. As such, he is one hell of an attractor for any other free electron in the neighborhood. So temporarily, another one is going to hop into that position, but he's not going to stay there very long. So it's hopping in and hopping out, and the charge is becoming more positive and going back to neutral again for a while. I don't think that's an energy loss or gain mechanism. Over to you, Glenn.
Indeed it is. It absolutely is. And if you open up your physics book and take a quick look at the chart for each individual atom and each individual energy shell, you'll see that there is an energy loss when that electron leaves. The only time that basically the atom itself as a structure maintains its balanced energy level is when all of the electrons are intact. So, but that's not to say that if two electrons come close to each other, they can exchange energy, they can. But once you exceed the maximum EV for one atom, then it will jump from one atom over to it will leave its orbit, and you can subtract basically the charge of that electron from that atom, and then you can add the charge to the next atom, and you can actually take that difference between those two atoms and add from one, subtract the other, and that's an energy transfer, or you can look at it as a loss or a gain, depending on what perspective you're looking at it in. KC2QIQ.
I've got a problem, and let me show you the scenario. I decide to watch copper atom number 5 for the next 10 events. His favorite local electron that he was born with, so to speak, decides to leave, leaving that copper molecule, copper atom, more positive. Another electron comes along and fills in that position. He stays for a while, and he leaves. Again, the copper molecule becomes more positive, and a third electron comes along and occupies. I watch 10 of those events. Before the very first leaving of the very first electron in the very beginning, by some magic, I know the total amount of energy of that particular copper molecule. 10 events downrange, when he's lost an electron and gained an electron 10 times in a row. And I stop the action at the time that the 10th electron comes along and joins him. If I measure the energy of that copper molecule number 5 after the 10th event, and I compare it to the first event, I think I'm going to come up with the exact same number. I can do that after 10 events. I can do that after 1,000 events. I can do it after 1,000,000 events. I keep coming back to the exact same energy. I don't think in the big picture, energy is being lost or gained. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Oh, absolutely it is, Dick. It definitely is, because think of it this way. In order for that energy of that electron to be tossed out of its valence shell over into another valence shell, that's one event. But in order for that to happen, that means that something got saturated next to it to push it out. And then for it to go to the next one, that has to be saturated to be pushed out of that one. So each event that thing's being pushed out, that happens 10 times, that's all lost, that's all heat. No energy is being transferred there. The electron movement is the heat. It's loss. It's only when the electrons are coming near each other and exchanging charge and maintaining the same orbits inside the same atoms that the energy is moving without loss. As a matter of fact, when you look at a superconductor with a mu of V equal to 0, that's basically what that definition is all of the